This episode is sponsored by Transcend, a veteran-owned and operated performance optimization company that I introduced recently as a sponsor on this show. Well, since then, I have actually been using my products and I've had incredible success. There was initial blood work that was extremely detailed, and based on that, they offered supplementation. So I began taking DHEA, BPC-157 for inflammation, based on the fact that I've been a stuntman, a martial artist, and a firefighter my whole life, lots of aches and pains, Dihexa to help cognition after multiple punches to the head and shift work, and peptides. 4 months later, they did a detailed blood work again, and I was actually able to taper off two of the peptides because my body had responded so well to just one of them that it was optimized at that point. So I cannot speak highly enough of the immense range of supplementation that they offer, whether it's male health, female health, peptides to boost your own testosterone, which I would argue is needed by a lot of the fire service, or whether it's exogenous testosterone needed, especially after TBIs or advanced age. Now, as I mentioned before, the other side of this company is an altruistic arm called the Transcend Foundation, which is putting veterans and first responders through some of their protocols free of charge. Now, Transcend are also offering you, the audience, 10% off their protocols. And you can find that on jamesgearing.com under the products tab. And if you want to hear more about Transcend and their story, listen to episode 808 with the founder, Ernie Colling, or go to transcendcompany.com. This episode is sponsored by Team Builder, yet another company that's doing great things for the first responder community. As a strength and conditioning coach myself, who also trains tactical athletes, dissemination of wellness information is one of the biggest challenges. Now, Team Builder is the premier strength and conditioning software for tactical athletes, and there are several features that really impress me. Firstly, there is a full exercise library, so you, the personal trainer, does not have to create that within your own department. Secondly, you can send out programming, but also individualize, which I love. So you blanket program for everyone. Now you can tweak based on someone's injury, someone's need to maybe drop some body composition, rather than having to write a program for every single person on their own. Team Builder also allows you to build custom questionnaires to collate health and wellness data. It integrates with wearables. And I think one of the most important things is obviously it tracks. To me, it's imperative that we as a profession start tracking our people from day one and then over the full span of their career, therefore catching potential wellness issues and injuries before they happen. Now, if you want to try Team Builder, they are offering you, the audience of the Behind the Shield podcast, a free 14-day trial to experience all of the features. And if you want to take a deeper dive into Team Builder, listen to episode 1032 with Melissa Mercado, or go to teambuilder.com. And I'll spell that to you because it's not as you'd think, teambuildr.com. Welcome to the Behind the Shield podcast. As always, my name's James Gearing, and this week it is my absolute honor to welcome on the show personal trainer, former Royal Marine PTI, and the man behind Tier 1 Coaching, Jim Redding. Now, in this conversation, we discuss a host of topics, from Jim's journey into the military, training the tactical athlete, obesity in the UK, his transition story, training our next generation of military, and so much more. Now, before we get to this incredible conversation, as I say every week, please just take a moment. Go to whichever app you listen to this on, subscribe to the show, leave feedback, and leave a rating. Every single 5-star rating truly does elevate this podcast, therefore making it easier for others to find. And this is a free library of well over 1,000 episodes now. So all I ask in return is that you help share these incredible men and women's stories so I can get them to every single person on planet Earth who needs to hear them. So that being said, I introduce to you Jim Redding. Enjoy.
Well, Jim, I want to start by saying thank you so much for taking the time and coming on the Behind the Shield podcast today.
No, thank you. Thank you for having me. I'm excited to get into it and get started.
And as I said to you, and I'll say to people listening now, I apologize for my voice. I've got the man flu and it's legit. So it's kicking my ass at the moment.
Going round. We've had it our end as well, mate. So it's all hitting us away.
Yeah, it'd be interesting to see the stats, actually, what it's doing, because this one hit me way harder than any of the COVID variants that I'm aware of. So I wonder what it's doing behind the scenes of some of our, you know, more vulnerable population.
Yes, mate. Absolutely. Absolutely. No, it's, we had it pretty bad myself, to be fair. Probably, again, worse than the COVID variation. So it's, it wiped me out for a week. Back into it now.
Yep. Sounds like the same one then. All right. Well, very first question, where on planet Earth are we finding you today?
I'm based in Reading at the moment. Born and bred in Reading. Family are down here. So yeah, down in the southeast in the UK.
Brilliant. Well, let's start there. So you said you were born and bred in Reading. Tell me a little bit about your family dynamic, what your parents did, how many siblings?
Yeah. So born in Reading Berkshire Hospital, 29th of July, 1991. Father ran his own business, from his sort of mid-20s, if you like, in the construction in the industry. Mum has always been in the healthcare industry, looking after the elderly, which has been class, and she's just, you know, always been a hard working lady themselves. Got three siblings, two older brothers and one older sister. So that's me in a nutshell.
What was your mum's experience during COVID? Because I mean, you know, not only being in healthcare but dealing with again a more vulnerable population, the elderly, that must have been a pretty powerful perspective that she had.
Yeah, I think. It wiped out a lot of the some of the older generation, and she had to deal with that, which was quite challenging. But you know, she loves the job, she loved helping people, and she just doesn't stop. She gets for a weird way a little bit of a buzz from that, helping people, not a buzz to see them, you know, fall short of things like COVID, but yeah, she gets stuck in, which is class.
Have you ever had a conversation with her about the relationship between what she does and what you do now? Because this is one of the things I think that was completely disregarded during COVID, certainly here in America, was making people healthier, like more resistant to any virus that comes across. And obviously that includes nutrition and fitness.
Yeah, to be fair, we don't really touch on that in all honesty. Of course we speak about what I do and what she does, but I guess we don't go into it in that much detail, if you like. But I think I get the skills, but the way I am around, like I thrive. I love helping people. I love that side of things, the whole generosity, gratitude things. I definitely get that from my mum. So that's really where that side of me comes, if you like.
Beautiful. Well, staying with your childhood, what were you playing and doing as far as exercise and sport?
Always been competitive. Always a competitive lad. As a young lad, I was into football, like most. Tried rugby, didn't really take to that very well. So it was always footy to me. Love running. Love like anything cross country. To be fair, I enjoyed anything sport related, anything where there was a bit of like competition, it was a bit of me. And then as I sort of grew up and, you know, fell in love with the fitness industry and fell into that sort of thing, if you like.
When you were younger as an athlete, were you exposed to strength and conditioning then? Because I know when I reflect back to my youth, you know, compared to what these American and school and colleges are having now, there's a very kind of embedded strength and conditioning program. It may not be taught properly, but there's an understanding that the two relate. When I reflect back to my childhood, which is a little, you know, before yours, I don't remember the schools really doing strength training or fitness training aside from simply playing sports.
Do you know what? I'd agree with that. I don't think, I think it was quite, should we say, old school mentality. I don't know. You just got like, you just went in the gym and or like playing sport. It was like, your classics, you know, jog on the spot, star jumps, and then you're straight into it. I was a bit naive to it until I sort of like, you know, got sort of year 10 in school where you could sort of pick what direction you wanted to take with your GCSEs, etc. That's when I sort of found, like, I think at school it's labeled physical education, and I loved it. It, to be fair, it was probably the only subject that I really took to at school, bar sort of sport and PE itself. So yeah, it was that time that I sort of was like, this is me, this is the space that I'm going to invest in, and it was the only route I was going to invest in, to be fair, and that's what sort of where I went and did my further external research in the area.
And at that point, had you got any family members in the military or anyone else who would kind of be an inspiration later to join the Royal Marines?
No, I was the first. Obviously, grandfather, everyone's grandfather. You know, we've got that heritage back in the days. But other than that, I was like the first out of the family, and the last to this point, you know, right now. So,
well, walk me through that journey then from GCSEs to how you found yourself in personal training.
Yeah. So, left school with one GCSE, which was physical education. You know, got a C in that. And then went off to college. And at college, I studied sports science. So, it was like a foundation BTEC sports science course, and then loved it, enjoyed it, did well in it, and went down the, it was called the BND sports science, which was like a national diploma, if you like. Finished that, and literally from that I went onto a government funded course, which was a level 2 fitness instructor course. You had to apply for it and go through a sort of like joining process because it was all funded, which I got through, was selected, went and did that course. And as part of that course, you had to do like a bit of work experience in a gym, which I did at a club called Castle Royal Golf and Country Club, which is around sort of Reading Way, Reading Maidenhead. Luckily enough, was picked up straight off that after like my placement into a job there, and walked the gym floor many years, walking the gym floor, writing training programs for sort of all clients. It was quite a premium country club, so you had a lot of the elderly, if you like, down to your sort of young lads. So programming for all sorts of ages and levels of fitness. And then I went into a PT course from there, and then it just, you know, went that sort of route, and I've never really steered away from it, in all honesty, until I joined the military. But then I found my way back into it. So, you know,
it's funny, I haven't heard the word BTEC in forever. I did the BTEC. I did BTEC and I did Diploma of Higher Education in exercise or sports science, I think it was, in University of North London. And BTEC, I don't remember really doing much studying as far as the classroom stuff. I just remember we played sports all the time, like every single sport there was. Is it the same one you did?
Yeah, probably, mate. Yeah. That's it. Just you can't beat the practical side of it, eh?
Yeah, that was so much fun. Really was. All right. Well, then, so now you go through the PT. So what started to be the evolution as far as your training principles compared to the textbook element of your kind of journey into fitness?
I think it was just getting stuck in. Like, honestly, like, I think like from, I remember at college that like, I'd always, you know, loved the, you know, I was quite a vain sort of young lad, 15, 16, you know, always dreamt of having these abs and, you know, muscles poking out. And I think I was just, but I was too young to really get stuck into a gym. And then obviously I couldn't afford a gym membership, but I had to, you know, chew my mum's ear off to get me stuck into a gym. And as soon as I had that gym membership, that was where you'd find me, you know. And I walked into the gym and I just saw the fitness instructors, the PTs. I was like, this is a bit of me. And I think I just, you know, they programmed me, you know, and I was learning from how they were programming me. Of course, I was learning from the course itself. And then I just, you know, got like, I think you just learn on the job. You learn training. You learn training yourself. You get into your own sort of habits. And obviously, because I was always invested in that, I'd always seek advice from others as well that have been there, done it, and learn from their mistakes and learn from what their experience. I love learning. I didn't realize that until I found until I got to year 10 at school where I could sort of do my GCSE. And that was the only, you know, as soon as I found that was me like, yeah, cool. This is my space. But before I found that, like, I hated learning. I was quite a disruptive child. And it wasn't until, like, I guess at school, you're taught to, you've got to be here, you've got to do this. It's the system of education that I never really bought into. But when I could buy into actually what I wanted to learn, and actually I was very good at it. I loved it, and I still love it today. So I've gone on a massive tangent there, James. I apologize.
No.
Here, there, and then back down to school.
That's pertinent, though. I had, I think my average from my GCSEs was Cs. So I was a C student. And when I went and became a firefighter and a paramedic, and all through the schooling, I was an A student. And the difference was, again, it was something that I truly understood. And even the maths and the physics and the chemistry, all that started to make sense now, whether it was a human body or whether it was fire. So I think this is it. It's, you know, a lot of people really don't get to ever tap into their potential if the only benchmark was a fixed education of their country.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's one of those, isn't it? When you're told, I think when it comes down to subjects like maths, algebra, and I just go, when am I going to use this? And if I can't see it, like how this is going to benefit me, and I'm sure it does some way down the line, but if I can't see it there and then, I'm like, I can't buy into it. It's just the way I've always been. And maybe it's an ignorant way, maybe not, but it's just how I've always processed things, I guess. And it got me into a lot of trouble at school, but it's all part of it. It's all part of the making of who we are today, right?
Absolutely. Well, what took you on the route to the military then?
What took me onto the route? So from the fitness industry, if you like, from PT, I actually wanted to be a school PE teacher. I wanted to go down the teaching route. And with that, I knew I had to have a degree. So I retook my GCSEs, my maths and English. Come to the time to submit the application to go to university, I applied, and you know, I knew I had the UCAS points, but I knew my GCSEs might sort of hinder me here. And of course, they did. I come up against that inevitable barrier where I didn't get taken by any universities. Instead of like just going, yeah, like, cheers, easy. I picked up the phone and I just called Southampton Solent University where I wanted to go. I wanted to do their course. Asked to speak to the head of sports science. I won't mention his name, but yeah, Dr. BL, should we say? And he was taken back. He was like, "Who's this lad?" Like calling me out. This has never happened before. And it was quite like one of those conversations. We had a really good chat. And he offered me in for an interview. It was like, I've never done this before, but you come in for an interview, and then. I had a good interview, and I was taking my math GCSE at the time, which I was predicted to see. He said, can you get a B grade? Of course, I just said in the moment, said yes. And he said, right, well, you know, show me you can get a B grade and you're in. We'll bring you in. Like, that was a fantastic interview. We want you on board. And I was like, cool, happy with that. Then I hit a bit of a barrier where I got myself into a little bit of trouble, where I picked up a criminal record, and it didn't do me any favors. I mean, I had to then just bring up Dr. BL and explain the story. Cool, you know, we got there, but he then made me promise him I'd get a first class degree. And that's why I was like, cool. That was my next goal, if you like. Teaching probably wasn't going to happen because of it becomes a bit of a barrier there. So my route changed, but I knew I loved sports science. I knew I wanted to do this course, and I went off and I did it, and I got a first class degree. Towards the back end of university, my third year, three of my friends all joined the Royal Marines, and they were like, Jim, this is you. This is right up your street. You know, it's hard. It's, you know, it's, there's ways to, you know, you can go through promotions, etc. And they just sold me this dream. And that was it. They were my influence. Like, I was like, cool. I like hard. I like anything challenging. I love the camaraderie. I love being around the guys. And, you know, that was my route in. It was never really it was never like, I'm not one of those lads that goes, since I was a kid, I dreamed of joining the military. I'd always had like little, like looked into it, but never really went for it. But it was my friends that sort of influenced my decision, if you like.
When I reflect back now, I did University of North London, I did sports science, and then University of Florida here, the Gators school, I did exercise physiology. And even though, you know, of course I learned a lot of people go into these schooling, you know, into this schooling expecting to have the toolbox that they need for coaching. And what I found was it was quite myopic, and really it almost seemed to set you up to stay in that system and now become a teacher of sports science rather than go out into the real world and apply the things you've learned or be in a lab, you know, testing very, very kind of narrow fields of improvement. With the route that you went on, how did your schooling affect your ability to teach when you graduated?
In the sense of, teaching...
Mine was very academic, so there wasn't really a lot of application to what we were learning. It was more theories, and like I said, this might create a, you know, 2% increase on, you know, muscle fiber contractility or something. Doesn't help you, as you said, at the country club teaching the teenager and the 70-year-old. So with that higher education level, did it add a lot of value to your ability as a coach, or did it fall short in some way?
It did. I think when you're coaching, unless you're coaching athletes, like real high level elite athletes, I think getting into the really finer detail, like people don't necessarily want to or need to know that. When I, you know, it's a bit different now with who I coach now, with, you know, potential Royal Marines. But like when I was PTing and I was PTing whilst at university, I think what you realise, what you get to know is actually people, they don't buy your PT sessions because of like your education and what you know. They buy into you. They buy into like, it's someone to spend time with. They don't want to spend time with someone that they don't like. Like, you know, they don't want to waste their money with an hour of like someone that some people do. Some people love that element of like, let's go down the gym and let's get thrashed by PT. But actually some people just want your time. They just want to have like a bit of enjoyment and get some fitness out of it, you know. But some people want that feeling of feeling good that fitness brings rather than necessarily the results. Does that make, not, it's very far and far between, but what I'm trying to say is like, yes, it did help when the people that, you know, wanted that little bit of the why, the reason behind it. But actually what I found in like the fitness industry, people just buy you because they like you. You know, that makes sense.
No, it does completely. What has been your kind of observation of the impact of the kind of mental health journey of some of these people that you end up coaching? Because when I've done a lot of the sessions, and again, I've never been a full-time coach, always been kind of like a, you know, part-time weekend warrior, but it's amazing when you unpack the person that you're coaching, their why. There's so much power to understanding why they even show up in the first place. Oh, I want to lose some weight. Okay, that's not good enough. Let's go. Why do you want to lose some weight? And then you start learning that they were bullied when they were young, or maybe they just left an abusive relationship, or, you know, whatever it is. And now you kind of are able to kind of dig into that when it comes to motivating them and giving them goals. So even though obviously we're taught mainly the kind of technical physical side in a lot of these programs, I realize how understated the psychological side was.
Yeah, absolutely. Fully agree with that. I think you've framed that up really well. It goes back to it, that the point that I made, you've just obviously elaborated on it in a much easier way to probably understand. But it's like, I think, again, it goes like, you don't get to understand, like the onion analogy, peeling back the layers, right? You don't get to understand this psychological side until you actually start coaching someone, until you get to know them. they don't come and say, "Look, Jim, I want you to be my PT," because of this that happened back in the I was bullied, you know, for my weight, or the, you know, they don't open up. They just say exactly like you said. I want to lose weight. I want to get big. I want to get juicy. You know, all of these things. Then once you get coaching, once you get to know them, build rapport, understand each other, this is where I think you get into that side of things. And I think that's, like, for me, that's a beautiful thing, because like that's like the training that I love as well. I love the mindset and understanding someone, their why, because I think when you know someone's why, the how is like that's our job, it's given the how. And I think that's why, again, I love the coaching process, is because everyone's different. If you coach everyone the same, well, okay, great. You might get these results, like, you know, get everyone in the calorie deficit of 1500 calories. Yeah, cool. But it's going to look good for you, for your like testimonials. But I it's got to be about them, right? It's their journey. So I'm a big believer of that. And I think that's where I come into my own with, like, again, going back to my mum, the caring side of things and the way she is there. I think that's the side that comes out of me in that sense, if you like.
Absolutely. All right, well, let's walk into the front door of the training then. How well do you feel like you were prepared from this journey that you'd been on? And then what were the highs and lows of the first few months of that?
So Royal Marine training, sorry.
Yes.
Physically prepared, yes. I think, like, I'd have done things differently, like, from what I've learned. But I was fit. And that was like, the fitness was never really an issue for me. I was always, you know, up there at the front of the pack in that sense. Everything else, like, I was not prepared. Like, again, my friends, like, that sold me this dream, they were natural, you know, the siblings, three brothers. Just it was in a heritage, right? They've, you know, family, previous, all military. This was like a new territory to me. And I'd just gone off like, "Oh, Jim, you'll love it. Like, down at the pub after a few drinks. Yeah, get involved, mate. It's a bit of you." And that's like, cool. What do you do? Fitness is like right up your street. Cool. Then it got into the soldier side and I was like, wow, this is like a different ball game. I was a bit like a bit naive going into that side of things. It was a bit of a steep learning curve in there. And I'm not the fastest learners. I'd say it took me a little bit to digest and get fully locked into I was just a slow learner in that sense, if you like. And it's a very fast paced course, the Royal Marines. So, yeah.
What did you see as far as the common denominator between the ones who passed and the ones who fell out?
Mindset, always. You've got to want it. And I think in training, you'll always get the chimp, the inner chimp in your head that's, you know, this is cold, this is wet, this is shit, this is sometimes like, you know, you've got nothing else to give. And that's the part of the job of the training team as well. In a sense, it's there to try and break you down. And I think when you get broken down, that's when it's easy to go like, that's my shit, I'm out of here. But if you can just hold on to that and keep that level-headed, that's what sets you apart.
I've seen it in the fire service too. You know, that why is huge. You know, if you're in the middle of a collapse maze that we have and it's hot and you're, you know, in all this gear and you're breathing off the tank on your back and you're wedged into this maze and you can't move and you can't, you know, even reach your mask if you need to pull it off, you know, there's that voice that tells you you just want to quit. However, you know, a lot of us, we're there for a reason, you know, and I think it's that why that is so important. And I've heard it so often. It's funny, even the Navy SEALs, a lot of them is if they don't pass selection, then the Navy can decide what they do. They could be turning wrenches on a submarine or something. So a lot of them, even that was the why, like failure was not an option. When you reflect back now, not having this burning desire to be in the Royal Marines initially, what was that why that kept you moving forward?
My friends that had been there and done it. It, you know, they were born in, you know, they were very, they took to it like water, you know, duck and water. They, two of them King's Badgemen, one Diamond, you know, they were, excelled in everything. I was just the guy that got the gym superior, and I was super fit and got recognized for that. Look, I wasn't bad. I wasn't bad in training. I was an original from start to finish, but I just wasn't, I just took to it a little bit slower than others. But I knew that competitive side of me, I was like, oh, fuck, they can do it. I can do it. And that was it, in all honesty. I think there were times where I was like, nah, this ain't me. There were times, but I've not got a quitting attitude in me, I guess. And they were just like there as well. And I knew that, they've got one up on me if I jack this in. So.
Had you spent a lot of time in the water?
Oh, loads. Yeah. Always. I was always the one getting thrashed for the, just admin was terrible. So I was in, just drying up puddles.
So did kind of remind me, I know you obviously end up as a PTI or a version of, did you deploy prior to that?
And just training exercises. We never, during the time I was in, I never deployed on any operations. Nothing ever happened in that sense, if you like, for us to really get stuck into anything, which is I think like I said, I'm not one of those that joined the Royal Marines because I wanted to, go and deploy and go to war. It was more of a, it was like a challenge, an experience, an adventure that I sort of wanted from it. But then I think once you do the training and that sort of gets instilled into you, you want to go and do it. It's what you're trained to do. And I'm probably being quite, very, I wasn't a bad recruit by any sense. I just like to, label on that a little bit, because I think you've got to stay humble in everything you do, right? And I think that's what it's about, right? Isn't it? But I think that's one thing I think if leaving the Royal Marines, I would have loved to have done is go on, do it, get an op or two under my belt. But then again, I'm a big believer of be careful what you wish for, because some guys don't come home, and that is the reality of it.
Yeah. Yeah, I had Mark Ormrod on the show a couple of times. Actually, had coffee with him when I was visiting Reorg. God, that was probably 2+ years ago now. But I mean, you get to see the impact of the service of some of our men and women if they come back. And it's a real conversation. Hopefully, something that people can be made to consider when they're sending our men and women to the next conflict is all these coffins that we've seen, all these men and women that come back missing limbs, or obviously the mental injuries that we see in so often. So, yeah, I mean, that careful what you wish for is true, because, I mean, we've seen what happens with 20 years of war in the US and the UK.
Absolutely. I think, I guess even your line of work, James, it's a similar sketch, right? You're trained to do what you guys do, and it's a serious job. It's a real job. And, it's great to get stuck in. Everyone wants to get stuck in when you're trained to do it. But you must have seen some tragic things, right? And it's like, in your time. I guess it goes back to be careful what you wish for, isn't it?
Absolutely. Well, I mean, what you're doing now, what I've done on the physical side and also with this podcast is obviously trying to help the men and women that are in uniform be the best version of themselves, so they have the highest chance of coming home and completing their mission. When did your kind of shift begin from Royal Marine recruit to PTI?
I think the reality was I was always going to fall down into that line of work. I think it was like, it was written in the stars, if you like. I remember in a recruit week 5 of training, family's day, your parents come down and, they get to see you do your phys and in the gymnasium, and they get a bit of a tour around the place. And they went to Parker Hall, which is the rehab center for the recruits in the Royal Marines, and obviously permanent staff, but it's more geared towards the recruits. And I remember my parents said that's where your line of work is. They could just see it. They could see that's probably where I'd end up. And I was like, nah, I had aspirations to go special forces and a mountain leader, all these things. I was like, I've done the fitness side of things. I want to go and you know, Excel and that. But the reality was, it was like, you know, actually stick to what your strengths are. And my strengths was Fizz. My strengths was the theory. And that was my love and my passion. So you can't go off to do, you know, it's not like the Navy or the RAF in the sense that you can pass out recruit training and just become a PTR. You have to promote or be recommended for promotion to a junior, to a corporal. And that's the point, five years into my career, where I got that positive recommend and the time that I could go off and do the aptitude for the PT course. And that's when I sort of fell into that line of work.
So I've heard, you know, the high standard that requires, that it's extremely hard to even gain that role. So kind of talk to me about the expectations along the crucible that is becoming a PTI in the Royal Marines.
Yeah, it's the course is just geared it's just a fraction. It really is. It's like, you know, you're redlining yourself for 17 weeks. The course is 17 weeks long. Of course, there's some theory side of it that there is, but it's a short course, it's a condensed course. It's more of just like, are you fit enough to be the standard of a PTI, Royal Marines PTI? You know, I remember as a recruit, you know, anyone that would walk towards me with a green lid, like you're like fucking terrified. I was 24 as a recruit, right? And I was like, still like, this is, you know, intimidating, right? But then when you see someone walk down with a white vest and a green lid, it's like, well, like I'm going to go the other way because I'm probably just going to get thrashed. If that's the case, you know, that's the sort of the persona they held on camp. Very, very, you know, serious dudes, right? And I think it's because the course that you go through, you earn the respect in that sense. Not to take anything away from any other courses in the Royal Marines, like, you know, we are a sort of like, you know, fierce warriors. You know, that's the reality. Of course, like some great soldiers in the branch, and some, you know, it's a very, you know, we've got experience from everywhere. But I think you just held on a quite a high pedestal because of the challenging nature of the course. In that sense.
So we talked about this a few weeks ago when we chatted. You now have this kind of, you know, journey when it comes to personal training on the civilian side. Now you enter the military. There's a lot of thrashing. At what point did you start to question in a positive way the training ethos and start thinking about maybe a metamorphosis of training Royal Marines?
Yeah, it's interesting. I think skinning this with recruits is like, I think you have to read the troop, because you're always going to get people that love it, people that hate it, people that are really like, you know, high level fizz, and people that aren't, that are just like, they're great soldiers, but they're not the best at the fizz side of things. And I think it has to be hard, right? I think like to really periodize their training and to get too academic in that sense, you can't really do enrollment. You can to a certain element, but these guys are eating not the best nutrition. They're in ration packs in the field. They're late nights. Their sleep's not great. They're you know, yomping heavy kit. I think you've got a syllabus, essentially. You've got to get them from point A to point B, and that's it. And how you get them there is like, You have to read the troop, obviously, but you have to hit the troop have to hit certain criteria, otherwise you get Patrick. And that's it. So I'd say like you can't really get too torn up on the whole linear periodization, etc., because I just don't think it necessarily works for training. Unfortunately, you know, I'd love to get into it, but you're just limited on time.
So that selection is going to stay as it is. So what made you start thinking about helping people prepare for entry into the Royal Marines and using a different training modality?
So I went from a PTI role and then I went into the rehab role, which is where, you know, like I said, which funnily enough, parents got it bang on. You have to go off and study again for that course as an exercise rehab instructor. It's a 6-month course, pretty intense. And that's when I worked past that course and worked down in the rehab center in the Royal Marines, that's when I noticed, like, that's when you see, like, the amount of injuries coming in, you know, to Royal Marines training. And nearly half of Hunt's company, so like the rehab troop, the guys in it are within the first 8 weeks of mainstream training, right? So that's near, you know, 50% of the Hunt's company. You know, there's sometimes, you know, we've had it up to sort of 200 people in Hunt's company at one point. It's not that now, it's definitely reduced, but when you look at those stats and you're thinking, then you look at the injuries, the main injuries we see, shin splints, you know, stress fractures, patellar tendinopathy, Achilles tendinopathy, all these preventable injuries, overuse injuries that can be reduced if the preparation leading up to Royal Marines is better and they're more conditioned coming into it, you can have a massive impact on that, on those stats. And that for me was like, when I was down there and I was seeing that, I was like, wow. And as a PTR, you can't necessarily, you haven't got the time to really do that. You have to push these guys hard. It's that preparation coming in. The bigger the foundation, the bigger the tower. You know, get this foundation, get this solid base, and then, you know, they're more likely to go off and be able to withstand Royal Marines training in the way that it's just got to be. But I think it starts with the prep that you do beforehand.
So as you start looking into it, what were you seeing as far as the detrimental philosophies on training to prepare for Royal Marines selection? And what were the different training modalities that you started thinking about?
It's just everything so like geared towards selection, which is like, do your press-ups, do your sit-ups, do your pull-ups, you know, do your bleep test, because this is going to get you to the start line. And that's just how the majority of these potential Royal Marines are training, because they just think about the start line. And that's right to do, because, you know, you've got to get to the start line before you can even think about that green lid and, you know, 36 weeks later down the line. But people just getting tunnel visioned into this way of training. And I think when you look at that, they're not building the robustness. They're not building the resilience. And every athlete, every potential Royal Marine is going to be different. A one-size-fits-all program just doesn't cut it in my eyes. These are guys that are serious. That do, you know, they're, to me, like, where do you see an elite athlete performing, you know, in the top 5% just following a program that someone's put together 20 years ago and they're just dishing out the same thing? They don't do that. They've got S&C coaches. They've got sports scientists. They've got, you know, and we can't go on that sports scientist, but we've got a mental performance coach and you know, PTIs and, you know, nutritionists on my team, because these guys, they're the top 5%. They're not elite athletes, but they're elite soldiers. And to me, they need to be they need to be treated with more individualized programming. And I think that's for me the passion and everything I have behind it, and the reason I want to deliver a better product for these guys.
So talk to me about your transition then. What made you decide to transition out the Royal Marines, and then how did that interact with what you're doing now?
Children, kids, you know, that was my why for coming out. I think, you know, you get one life, right? And you've got to make the most of it. And I think, like, in the Royal Marines, I ticked off everything I wanted to do. Like, I do believe, like, I loved it. I loved my time as a PTI. I could see myself, you know, promoting through the branch and really wanting to have an impact in that area, because it's such a passion of mine and an area I'm so passionate and love. But I ticked off my boxes. I wanted, you know, in the end, I wanted to become a PTI. Then I wanted to become an ERI. And then and that was it. There was a few things that I wanted to do. I would love to have, you know, gone on the tour and operated it. But these are things that are out of my control. And I think when you realize that, and you think about, you know, your family and your kids and wanting to, you know, I want to be at home with them and see my kids grow up, I think that was a time that I was like, yeah, I've done it. I've completed it. I'm coming out. And the time that I decided I want to come out, I hadn't set up I hadn't set up tier one coaching. It wasn't a thing. But I knew I was going to leave. And at that point, I think, like, I'm very motivated, and I'm very, if I want something, I'll, I'll make it happen. And I don't mean to say that in an arrogant way. It's just the way I've always been. If I want it, I'll get it. And I think, and that's fortunately tier one coaching's taken off, and we're having great success with it, and delivering great results. And that's class. So I'm still like, although I'm out of Royal Marines now, I'm still part of it, you know, in a sense. So it's cool. Yeah. It's been hard, but going from military life to civilian life, it's definitely had its challenges, especially when you go self-employed and you've got to make your own routine, and it's not all been plain sailing in that sense.
What have been the challenges? Because right from the get-go, you talk about, you know, going in and this, you know, being an experience and adventure, and then, you know, you find yourself in the coaching space again. So it doesn't sound like there would be as many jarring elements as maybe some of these men and women that we've had that, you know, that was all they dreamed about. They went straight in from school and they were in for, you know, 10, 15, 20 years. And then they come out and that's all they've known. And that was their burning desire. That was their identity. Mm. And, you know, it's extremely jarring, but what did you find jarring through your perspective of the transition out?
Yeah. Going into Royal Marines, I had some good life experience already. I went in as I was 24. So I had that civilian side of things where, like you said, I didn't go in as a 16-year-old straight out of school. So I had that side of it that worked in my favor. But actually it's the going home and actually living with my missus, my partner, right? I've never lived with her full time, right? So now I'm living with her full time. And my two young kids, which are 3 and 1, and love them to bits. And it's why I want to come out of it. You know, I want to be at home. But you transition into their routine. They've got a routine as well. And like, I'm just there now, like rocking the boats in that sense. Look, we're super, like, we love it. We're always like, so I'm happy, I'm home, you know, and they are too. But it's even like, I manage my own time now, like as a fortunate business owner, but I work from home, so I'm always at home. You know, the Royal Marines took me away from home as well, so I could have that, like, right, back with the boys, let's go. Yeah, cool. I run a business. Do you know? I'm so busy juggling spinning plates, family, business, military, and I've gone from that really busy life to now like, I've got a, you know, business, being in business, a business owner can be quite a lonely place at times, right? And you've got to make work, you've got to make things happen. And I'm not spinning all these plates anymore and actually reacting, dealing with that, and just being okay to actually just take a chill pill for an hour or two. I've got nothing to do. It's been quite challenging because I've always been go, go, go. So it's, yeah, it's been multiple things that I've not found it super difficult, but I have. I've had times where I've been like, geez, this is harder than I thought, for sure.
Yeah, something I've said a lot to the fire service a lot is, you know, we've historically, when it comes to the contract negotiations, we chase an increase in our wages. But what's happening here in America is a lot of them work 56 hours a week. They're short staffed, so now it's 80 hours a week sometimes. And the ultimate currency is actually time with your family. And I transitioned out, you know, partly because of that. You know, you transitioned out because of that. And I think it's important. Doesn't mean you have to leave, you know, your uniform profession. But in my case, where it's being abused and these men and women are being kept from their families way more than they should, you know, now they're so sleep deprived, they lose the ability to fight. You know, that is the most important thing. If your kids turn, you know, 16, 18, and you've missed their childhood because you were so embedded in that profession, you know, then you come out the other side, that shame and guilt is going to be immense. So finding that balance, whether it's, you know, being able to navigate it through a military career or in my profession, simply fighting for a work week that puts you home when you should be at home. You know, that's if it's not for them, then for who? Like, is to me, that is the most important thing. Serving your country, protecting your community, absolutely admirable. But if it's at the expense of your family, it wasn't worth it.
100%. Yeah. Amen. I think, I can't remember the exact quote. I'm going to say it very wrong, but it's, you know, time is the only currency that you do not know the value of, right? We all know our bank balance. We all know, you know, how much time, you know, how much money we've got. You don't know when your time's up. And I think making the most of that is essential, right? And, you know, we get one life, and I think, like, it's precious. So you've got to, And I think for me, that was like the thing with the military. I think so many people can stay in the military and overstay the welcome because it's comfortable. Not always. It has its challenges. Of course it does. But you know where you've got to be, you know, and it's probably, you know, same with the fire service. You've got time. You've got to you've got a solid structure. And you know, I could do a bad job right down in Park Hall. Like, for, you know, I don't believe I ever did. I think I, you know, very credible and love doing it. So, but I still get paid at the end of the month. Whatever I do, I get paid because it's comfortable. But now, like, so it's easy to stay there. And then people overstay their welcome. And I think people resent it and they get that side of it. And then everyone's just, you know, and then a lot of people then stay for their pension because that's, you know, I've just got to stay now because they could say that, you know, I'm trapped or however. For me, it was just actually like, I loved the Corps. I left really like, still absolutely love it. Loved everything I'd done. And I've been able to walk away from it in a really good headspace. That I don't resent any of it. I've had the best time there, but actually it was my time to go. It was my time to move on. And I think had I overstayed my welcome, I might have left resenting it because I've missed so much time with my kids. And then they you know, and it's not till later life. And you're like, what did I stay for another 5 or 10 years waiting for my pension? When actually, like, that's worth more than any money. It's my time, my children, being able to, you know, have the freedom to do what I want when I want with them. That's class. So that's for me, like, yeah, you've hit the nail on the head with that.
Yeah, I agree 100%. Well, talk to me about Tier 1 coaching then. Firstly, from a training point of view, what are you able to do with these young potential recruits to prepare them for the beasting that they're going to get when they go through selection?
Yeah, Tier 1 coaching, you know, yeah, I set it up in July 23. So we're under 2 years now, and you know, in the space. And like I said, I set it up because I felt like there needed to be something out there. There's plenty of people out there doing this military preparation stuff, but I don't think everyone's out there doing it for the right reasons. And there's a little bit of lack of credibility in the space as well, in my personal opinion. And I just think, you know, I knew the value I could bring to the space. I had my why, and then I went and found my how, you know, and I think like, what do we do different? I think it's that empathy piece. That's, you know, we've not only been, you know, the team not only been through Royal Marines training, they've not had the stripes in that sense. We've all seen it as PTIs. We've all seen what these guys commonly fail with the professional failing points, the common injuries that are sustained. And I think when you add that to what we can bring, I think it just makes everything a little bit more fine-tuned in that sense. Yes, and I think it's the, like I said, the bigger the foundation, the bigger the tower. Let's work on the foundations and then let's get a little bit more specific towards the selection piece as we get closer to it. But everyone's different, right? Everyone's it's looking at the individual and where their weaknesses are, which I think we can really get into the nitty-gritty part at Tier 1 coaching.
So what were some of the contributing factors that you were seeing with the wrong programming that was creating this overuse injury problem?
So I think where I believe military preparation coaches, some are going wrong, is they think because as a Royal Marine commando, as a Royal Marine recruit, you're going to get thrashed, right? That's part of the, you know, that's it. You know, we keep using this terminology thrash, but it's terminology that these potential Royal Marines will hear a lot at Limpson. Now, because like that's what you do during recruit training, that's part of it. People think you've just, and this isn't just, you know, these are just potential Royal Marines as well. These lads, just young lads, hear this, that this is what they're going to do. So let's thrash ourselves. Let's train twice a day or three times a day and just absolutely send it before we get down to Royal Marines training, because that's what they'll do at Royal Marines training or think they'll do. So everyone just starts thrashing themselves before they get there. Funny old thing, they rock up, they burn out at a higher risk of injury. they've been running with weight on their back, like, you know, for 6 months before even rocking up to training, where everything's done periodized in that sense. It definitely is in that sense. You know, we build up to that. And I think where, like, even military preparation coaches are going that haven't got this experience as PTIs, ERIs, that haven't seen it from the space that I have, my team have, they're delivering from their experience, and their experience is what they experience in Royal Marines training. And I think then they start thrashing these guys and just go, you need to do this, 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 and keep doing more of that. And actually, they're just, it's detrimental rather than positive. And, you know, I just think that's what I'm seeing a lot of right now.
Now, what about kind of principles as far as what you're using? Like, for example, in the fire service, when I do coach, I like to use sleds, sandbags, you know, for the carries, for the pushes and the pulls. That's what we do, you know, on the fire ground. And so there's some real value to those kind of implements over and above if people are triathletes or crossfitters or, you know, whatever it is. What are you finding as far as tools that are helping these people prepare for this selection?
Again, I'll go, like, as a like, everyone's different, right? So I, to answer that exactly would be difficult. But what we will do is we'll screen these athletes. When we see, you know, when we get them on the pathway, it's like, let's look at how they move. Let's see if we can identify any weaknesses, any imbalances. And if we get them early enough, then let's just build the foundations. Let's just look at compound lifts. Let's not start. It doesn't have to get to be too exciting. It's just basic S&C that we can really build on to create a robust, resilient body. Then obviously we've got, as we get closer towards the pre-joining fitness assessment, the CPC, where they'll start to, you know, they'll need press-ups, they'll need sit-ups, they'll need to pass this bleep test, all the elements are there. Then that's when the specificity really, really comes into that part. Now, like, everyone thinks that, cool, pass my CPC, see you later, I'm off, and I'm ready to be a Royal Marine Commando. Well, actually, wait one. Let's just now think about, like you're saying, the sled pulls, the single leg strength work, all of this, you know, stuff now where we're thinking about the dynamics there. Because, you know, you go out for a run and without any weight on your back, average, you know, 3 to 5 times your body weight is going through a single limb every step. Now, that's the general principle that they say. Now, add weight on your back, that times out over so many steps, you know, your big 10K yomp, your speed march. Wow, that's some serious load going through your single limbs there. So, you know, that's where I think getting super tuned into that side of things, that has to come. But you need to build the foundation. You need to get through your CPC, and then, like, just now let's look at that element. And I'm not like, I always say to our guys, look, if you want to pass your CPC and just go off to Royal Marines training next week, that's on you. I kind of like, that's not like, that's totally up to you. And I respect that. But I'm not here to hold you back, but I'm just, if I can reduce, like, a little, you know, spend a few more weeks doing X, Y, Z to save your trip to Hunter Company, that I can't promise, but I'll do everything I can within my power, and so will the team. And we can keep you on the right track and the right trajectory the right way. Well, that's what it's all about, isn't it? So, it's a very difficult one to say, but I think everyone's different, but it's making sure you're hitting all principles.
Have you had any indication from within the success of the preparation program on the recruits and the reduction of people visiting Hunter Company?
I think Hunter Company right now is lowest it's been in a long time, which is great. And that's credit to the guys down at Limpson. You know, I've literally just come out of that job, and they've got a super credible team down there who are there, you know, delivering the right things for the right reasons. They're all, you know, super invested in that space. So I think that comes down to it. I think that the pass out rate has gone up. I can't remember exactly what it is, but it's been the highest in years. That could be multiple reasons. You know, I would never label it down as the work we're doing, but do I think we've influenced that? 100%. Of course I do.
Brilliant. Well, I want to hit, just kind of pull back a little bit on the lens. I get to go home usually once a year. It's back to the UK, and I'm usually kind of, you know, visiting other places too. And sadly, every time I go home, the obesity epidemic that I see in America is becoming more and more and more prevalent in the UK, which breaks my heart. What are you seeing as far as the the number of young men and women that are even eligible to test for this profession now, based on the kind of dwindling health that I'm seeing in the UK.
Yeah, it's tragic, really. I don't know why it is, because I do believe, like, the fitness industry, the health and fitness industry is like, it's definitely, like, since COVID has hit a peak, everyone talks about it. You know, the amount of people that I see drinking 0% beer and things like that has shot up as well, which is great. I think it's awesome. And you know, I'm one that I love to have a beer, but I do love 0% as well. It's like, you know, it's great to have that aspect. So I do think the health has got better in some aspects, but it's far and far between. There's no, like, in between. It seems like people are super, like, they're into their fitness and they're invested in the space, or they just completely rap on it. I don't know, you know, I haven't got the answer. Of course, we don't have the answers for that, but it's definitely, like you said, it's definitely something that needs to be taken a little bit more serious, because, you know, it helps everything.
What are you hearing as far as a national conversation? Because the thing that blows me away, I hold the NHS as the best healthcare system on the planet, but when it was done properly, which is a long time ago now, sadly, and I'm not talking about the people in the system, they're blooming, you know, angels for being able to operate within that broken system. What blows me away is the reason why it's so torn apart, apart from, you know, the politics behind privatization and stuff, is the fact that it relies on a healthy nation. And if you have a tax-based healthcare system, in theory, that should drive the healthiest nation on the planet, because you don't want to use that tax money. You know, you want to use it as little as possible. So, you know, childbirths and the elderly and car accidents and things where you absolutely have to intervene. But you would think with a tax-based healthcare system, there would be a constant national push to make British people as healthy as possible. It just, you know, it's simple economics. But I see the opposite, and it just... I don't understand why there isn't a national voice, you know, really, especially after COVID, saying nationally, we need to get our kids, you know, eating better and moving more, and the same with our adults too. So what are you seeing as far as a disconnect between the actual health of the British people and the message that's coming out of whatever national voice is?
Yeah. I just don't think actually I just don't think people really care about it that much. I honestly don't. I think, like, it's too easy, you know, the government, you know, the benefits, everything, you know, I think it's too easy for people these days to use and abuse the system. It's not really taken serious enough. And I think, like, because of that, No one cares. Like, do you know what I'm saying? Like, it's quite a sad thing, really. But, like, I don't think there's much push on. I think if you want to eat healthy and, you know, follow this health route, I think it comes down to you, your want and desire. I don't think anyone's out there really. Of course, there's things out there. Of course, there is. And it is easy accessible. But I do believe it just comes down to the individual and how, if they want to get digested in it, and the support out there isn't really like all that, I think, to steer these people down that route.
Yeah.
I'd say, you know, social media has such an influence on this. But again, it's like for the right reasons. But then again, some people, like, for the wrong reasons. And then some people go down a real, like, hole with it, because then they feel guilty, they feel the shame, they feel, you know, oh, why can't I do that, and why can't I look like that, and then they go and abuse the system and then start getting all sorts of, you know, there's all sorts of things going now, isn't it, like there's pills, there's all sorts that people can just take to lose weight and avoid this. And I think, like, yeah, it's one of those, it's too easy to abuse, I think.
Yeah, it's so sad, because I talk about this even with kindness and compassion and community. When I grew up in, you know, my childhood was basically the 80s and 90s, you know, we had Blue Peter, which was, I don't know if it's still going now, but it was, you know, it was constantly talking about things that were going on in the world. They were constantly getting national fundraisers going on. We had John Craven's News Round that was like a kid's version of news, and it was all, this is what's going on, not opinions, not bias, just, you know, and it would pull everyone together, and we'd raise money, you know, for Ethiopia, for, you know, whatever the thing was. And there was a real sense of, you know, pulling together as a country and doing good things for other people. And I remember, you know, people like the overweight person, air quotes, that I remember in school was nothing compared to today. And that was, you know, the most overweight in the whole school. And so it is, it's environment. And it's so sad because I think there's no greater red flag than COVID to turn this thing around. And yet I'm not in the UK, so I don't get to really see it, you know, up close and personal. But here in America, it was completely swept under the carpet. No one wanted to hear about the health of the individual, pre-existing conditions, obesity crisis, none of that. It was the virus and the virus only, and you have to wear masks and get vaccines and that's it. And, you know, and now on the other side of this, we realize, A, yes, it was a real virus, but it was dependent on the health of the individual. And the fact that we discarded such an important lesson from Mother Nature, which is you have a sick population, you've got to turn that around. And it's not changing in America and it's not changing in the UK. I mean, the average person needs to get angry about this and start asking why. Because I know in America, I know exactly why. Because there is a billion, if not trillion industry that is pharmacy here, you know, the pharmaceutical companies. Their customer is a sick person. They don't want you healthy and they don't want you dead. But we don't have that same system in England, in the UK. So that's why I'm questioning, why is this same crisis being allowed to happen when it's destroying arguably the best healthcare system on the planet?
Yeah. I'll be honest. I think it's quite corrupt. I think the whole COVID thing was corrupt. I don't believe it was, you know, just plunge out of thin air. I think it was in labs, right? It's been spoken about many times, and I just don't trust the system. Unfortunately, I don't trust it. And it's why I never really keep up with the news, essentially, is because it's propaganda. It's all conspiracy. I don't know. That's just my mindset and what I believe. So I try to stay away from it because it does make me quite, I think you can get to it. It's negative. There's nothing ever positive that comes out from these things, you know?
Yeah, but there used to be. That's the thing. The TV used to be so positive in the UK. So I don't understand what happened, like how it turned. And I saw it in COVID too, you know, and all the incredible frontline personnel and first responders that were heroes in one breath and then murderers the next because they didn't take a vaccine. You know, I don't remember the BBC having opinions. They used to just report. And this is what I think that we as a nation, we as a globe need to take a step back and really question the propaganda in our own country. Because, you know, COVID was a real thing. Wherever it came from, it was a virus that was killing people. Some of my friends, you know, had it and almost died. But there was a huge lesson from it. And it was being, you know, discarded. And this is what just blows my mind is, and forget the virus. Because of this obesity crisis, millions of people are dying. There's no ticker on the freaking news station for that. There's no one, you know, in outrage from all the people that are dying from strokes and heart diseases and cancers. And it's just a shoulder shrugging. And so, you know, going back to what we're talking about, even national security, the smaller amount of people that we have to be a Royal Marine or a firefighter, the more vulnerable that nation becomes for other things too. So it is a really important conversation. And I don't, you know, I hope that we are going to turn it around, because I hear a lot of just as you alluded to, a lot of the candidates that we are getting in these fields, I'm hearing people say they're in incredible shape. Like they're fitter and stronger than my generation that we're testing. And that's an amazing thing. So like you said, the group that gets it really get it. And they've got this amazing renaissance of, you know, strength and conditioning and nutrition information, and they're forging better tactical athletes. But it's the rest of them, we're failing the rest of the average, you know, person who their lifespan is being shortened woefully because of, you know, of what? I don't understand. There's no greater mark of leadership than the health of the nation. And yet people just kind of shrug their shoulders and just get on with it.
Yeah. Yeah. But, you know, I go back to like the COVID, right, when that was all kicking off, and then you'd have the government, you know, all having their knees up when everyone else was locked down.
Yeah.
So they've lost that trust. They've lost that buy-in straight away. You know, these are the leaders. These are the leaders that we everyone looks up to for answers, decisions. And when you start to, well, that was like one of the biggest things where you know, you lost me. You lost me. Like you're telling me I've got to, you know, trust this whole process. And I actually, you know, I think you said it there, like more people get sick since COVID. Like what's going on with that? The immune systems and, you know, why are people dying of cancer, heart attacks, strokes, blood clots? So much. I don't know whether it's just something I've noticed right now, because it seems to be happening a lot around that I've seen around me. But there's a lot of questions to be answered around that space, I think.
Absolutely. All right. Well, I'm going to round off with some closing questions. The first I love to ask, is there a book or are there books that you love to recommend? They can be. Oh, my goodness. I can't even spit out my closing question. Let me try that again. Is there a book or are there books that you love to recommend? It can be related to our discussion today or completely unrelated.
Oh, I've got so many. Right, the Slight Edge is a must read. The Slight Edge. It talks about like 1% marginal gains and the things that are easy to do, but easy not to do. And these are the things, like these are the things you need to do, because they're the things that can make the real impact. And I'm a big believer of like 1% marginal gains, and that can have such an influence in your life moving forward in anything, whether it's education, fitness, whatever you love doing. These 1% gains are critical. Atomic Habits is a great book. You know, it talks about. This is the proof's in the pudding, right? They say miss a habit once is a mistake. Miss a habit twice is a new habit, and that's like sort of the whole sort of atomic habits. Top two that. I've can't think of another on my mind right now, but yeah, I love the digesting all this stuff. I think it's great.
Brilliant. What about films and documentaries?
Films and documentaries. For me, I like reality stuff. You know, I like the Last Dance. You know, Michael Jordan. Anything like that, really. You know, I really like Kanye West's one, Yeezy, I think it's called. You know, I think that, like, he, exceptional character, knocked down a lot during his whole career building up to Kanye West, who he is today. Obviously, a lot of challenges of his own along the way. But I think it's things like that that have got me through to where I am today. Is like, I thrive off this sort of, like, negative, dark energy. I thrive off this dark side. Where, like, tell me I can't do it, I'll show you I can, sort of thing. So yeah, that's like that was a massive. That, yeah, anything like his stuff has been great. But yeah, I'd say more reality stuff like that. Anything that inspires me.
Yeah,
and I think inspires.
The Last Dance was phenomenal.
Yeah, class. It's absolutely great documentary.
All right. Well, the next question, is there a person that you recommend to come on this podcast as a guest to speak to the first responders, military and associated professions of the world?
Yeah, actually, Chris Hunt, who works on the Tier 1 Pathway as our mental performance coach. Exceptional guy. A former bootneck himself, ex-Royal, done two, maybe three tours. He's a cool dude, and he's super knowledgeable and loves this space. He'd be great for it. Yeah.
Fantastic. All right. Well, then the very last question before we make sure everyone knows where to find you and Tier 1 Coaching. What do you do to decompress?
Decompress, family time. Just time with my kids. Family's everything to me. So yeah, I'd say that's number one. But fitness, of course.
Brilliant. All right. Well, then for people listening, where are the best places to find Tier 1 and or you on the web or social media?
Yeah, social media, Instagram, gym_Tier 1. I've just launched a podcast, actually, myself, the Tier 1 Coaching Podcast on Spotify, Apple Music, which would be cool. Really looking to get stuck into that. They're the main platforms, I'd say. But I'd love to, you know, take advantage of all these platforms. I think it's great that the more wealth and knowledge we can push out to inspire recruits, people going into any service, any walk of life, I think it's a great space to be invested in. I think the work you're doing, James, is great. And again, really, really appreciate this time to have a chat and hopefully some people can digest some good stuff from it.